Welcome to Plabable, Pods for Docs. My name is Sophia, and today we're going to enter the world of nephrology by discussing nephrotic syndrome. For visual aids on today's topic, head over to our website at plabable.com for high-yield revision notes and a question bank. Today, we are very fortunate to be joined by Esther, who's a renal registrar, who's going to take us through this topic. Esther, do you want to introduce yourself and tell us a bit about your interests?
So I am a renal registrar in training, and currently I am in renal medicine. Throughout my training, I have worked in St. George's University Hospital as a transplant registrar in renal medicine, and currently I work as a medical education fellow in Brighton Sussex Medical School, but with my background job as a renal training registrar in Brighton Royal Sussex County Hospital.
Let's dive right into the topic then. So let's start with the basics. Esther, do you mind defining for us what nephrotic syndrome is and why we need to know about it?
Yes, certainly. So nephrotic syndrome is actually a clinical syndrome where there is a triad of clinical presentation, and the triad consists of proteinuria of more than 3.5 grams per day associated with hypoalbuminemia, which is low albumin in the bloodstream, and associated with generalized edema. In some patients, they may have syndromes of hypercoagulability, and hyperlipidemia. The reason why this is an important topic, mainly because it is one of the most common referrals to the renal services from primary care and from secondary care. These diseases are generally treatable once we find the underlying cause, and having proteinuria is usually an indication of a primary renal disease, meaning that there is a loss of the integrity to the glomerular filtration barrier, which normally restricts the filtration of proteins, causing disease to the glomerular filtration barrier.
So now that we know what we're talking about, could you give us an indication of how common it is to come across someone with nephrotic syndrome?
So glomerular disease actually accounts for about 25% of chronic kidney disease worldwide, and this is excluding diabetic nephropathy. However, we do not really see nephrotic syndrome very commonly in the usual day-to-day practice. To put things in perspective, nephrotic syndrome can be more common in children than in adults, and the most common cause of nephrotic syndrome in children is minimal change disease, whereas the most common cause of adult nephrotic syndrome is focal segmental glomerulosclerosis. In my own clinical practice, however, I do see a lot of nephrotic syndrome basically because they are all referred to us. But as I say, the most common cause of adult nephrotic syndrome that we see are focal segmental glomerulosclerosis. Apart from that, the second common cause would be diabetic nephropathy and followed by membranous nephropathy.
So Esther, I believe you've touched on this briefly already, but understanding the underpinning pathophysiology behind a disease often makes it easier for people to understand the clinical manifestations and, you know, how to manage the case as well. I believe the underpinning pathophysiology is to do with podocyte pathology. Could you give us a bit more detail as to what specifically happens and how that correlates to the clinical findings that we see in nephrotic syndrome?
Right. So that is a very good question. So the pathophysiology of nephrotic syndrome stems from a diseased glomerular filtration barrier. The glomerular filtration barrier has a key component called the podocytes. The podocytes has its foot processes that acts as a selective filtration barrier for electrolytes and also for selective amounts of protein with small molecular weights. The examples of these proteins are albumin, small amounts of hemoglobin, and beta-2 microglobulins. In a disease filtration membrane, the podocyte foot processes then get effaced due to inflammation. And when this happens, the filtration barrier lost its integrity of its selective functionality, and it then results in loss of large amounts of protein, blood, and larger molecular weight proteins such as immunoglobulins, fibrinolytic factors, and coagulating factors, as well as other types of proteins, leading to loss of protein in the blood, causing hypoalbuminemia and the resultant proteinuria, which causes the presentation of edema.
Nephrotic syndrome is, at the end of the day, a syndrome. It's what it says on the tin. It's not an actual definitive disease in its own right, meaning that something else has typically caused that state to come about. And it's important to recognize nephrotic syndrome, as that can often be a clue to diagnose what the cause of the nephrotic syndrome is. I believe nephrotic syndrome is commonly caused by slightly different diseases from person to person. Do you mind telling us a bit about these different conditions that can cause a picture of nephrotic syndrome?
Yes, certainly. In my own clinical practice, I normally divide the classifications of causes into two types in nephrotic syndrome. One is of primary causes, which means that the disease comes from a direct insult into the kidney itself. One is of secondary causes, which means that the patient suffers from some kind of systemic disease, which has resulted in a complication that causes the inflammation and disease process into the glomerular filtration barrier, causing the nephrotic syndrome. So let's start with the most common cause of nephrotic syndrome in children, which is minimal change nephropathy. Minimal change nephropathy, the underlying cause is idiopathic, but it can also be associated with a recent infection, usually viral infection, and associated with NSAIDs, poisoning, or hematological malignancies. There are no immediate evidence to say that these are the direct causes. However, I cannot talk about nephrotic syndrome without touching on histology, as you know that this is quite common in nephrology. Hence, I would like to touch on to say that minimal change nephropathy, as the name suggests, it does not have a lot of change in light microscopy. If you look at the cross-section of the glomerulus, it will look normal under light microscopy, but you will only see the diffuse effacement of podocyte foot processes under electron microscopy. So that would be the primary characteristic of the diagnosis of minimal change nephropathy. And you can only diagnose it by biopsy. I will then move on to membranous nephropathy. So as I mentioned before, this is the second most common cause of nephrotic syndrome as compared to focal segmental glomerulosclerosis. And usually the onset is around 40 to 60 year old adults, and it has a larger propensity in male as opposed to female patients. 75% of membranous nephropathy is idiopathic. However, 25% of membranous nephropathy is associated with malignancy. The histology in membranous nephropathy, just remember the keywords, you will see spikes seen in the glomerular basement membrane. These spikes are contributed by the appearance of immune complex deposits on the basement membrane, which is the main cause of inflammation. The next primary cause, focal segmental glomerulosclerosis, in short, FSGS. As the name suggests, this actually is a pathological description of a disease. It can be idiopathic. It can also be associated with HIV, pomegranate use, and obesity as well. Histologically, it appears that there is scarring, or also known as sclerotic lesions, in some of the glomerulus, hence the name focal, and some parts of the glomerulus, hence the name segmental. And if you look at it under electron microscopy, again, it has diffuse podocyte foot process effacement. And you have to marry this sign with the sclerotic lesions that is seen under light microscopy in order to make this diagnosis. Moving on to secondary causes, I am just going to touch on this very briefly. So the most common secondary cause of nephrotic syndrome, I would say, would be diabetic nephropathy. And the histology that appears in diabetic nephropathy are chemostole Wilson nodules. If you look at it under microscopy, they just look like round pink stuff within the glomerulus. And the patient has to have a long-standing history of diabetic nephropathy, and other tests will have to rule out other causes. A very important differential diagnosis of diabetic nephropathy on histology is amyloidosis. Renal amyloidosis presents with nephrotic syndrome, and it is a multi-system disorder, as you would have studied before. I will not go into a huge detail in this, but basically it is a disease where there is an abnormal deposition of extracellular proteins, which is caused by abnormal immunoglobulins, or it is caused by chronic inflammatory disease. And these deposits can go anywhere in the body. And when it deposits into the kidneys, it becomes a disease of the kidney, resulting in nephrotic syndrome, especially when it deposits in the glomerulus.
Just to summarize that section, so the important things to remember is that you've got these primary causes and you've got the secondary causes. So your primary causes are your minimal change disease, your FSGS, and your membranous nephropathy, whereas your secondary causes are more systemic disorders like diabetic nephropathy and your amyloidosis being your secondary causes of nephrotic syndrome. So let's now move on to think about the clinical signs that we'd see in someone with nephrotic syndrome. So typically, we do like to use patient scenarios just to illustrate it a little bit better for our listeners. So let's consider this. A 7-year-old boy is brought in by his mother. There's a 4-day history of facial swelling, especially around the eyes. And this has worsened over time. And the mother reports that she's now noticed his legs have also become a bit swollen. She also tells you that her son had coryza-like symptoms around a week ago, but he's otherwise fit and well with no underlying medical conditions at all. Esther, could you highlight the salient points in this presentation that may lead you to consider nephrotic syndrome in this child?
So first of all, we can see that this patient's age group is that this is a child presenting with facial edema and with a typical feature of the edema around the eyelids, and it has worsened over time. And then it has then spread into general areas in his body. So facial edema in children is usually the common sign to consider nephrotic syndrome in this situation. And however, in adults, I must point out that not all of the adults who present with nephrotic syndrome has puffy swelling in around the eyes. And usually they present more of pitting edema in the lower extremities. And sometimes they may spread into the upper extremities as well, and also around the sacral area and the abdominal area. So these are the important signs of edema to consider nephrotic syndrome. And as I mentioned before, some of the underlying cause of the nephrotic syndrome, a lot of the clues will come from the history of presenting complaint itself. Considering that there is a viral-like symptom recently, this will then point you towards the possible diagnosis of minimal change disease in this situation causing the nephrotic syndrome.
So having looked at this scenario and just considered the clinical presentation of nephrotic syndrome as a whole, what are the important extrarenal differentials to bear in mind when you're thinking about nephrotic syndrome?
Yes, it is easy to get confused because there are other systemic causes that presents as edema as well. So other considerations of differential diagnosis of edema would be congestive cardiac failure, chronic liver disease, and lymphedema. All three of them are associated with edema. However, the way to confirm your diagnosis of nephrotic syndrome to rule out these three main differentials would be a urine protein creatinine ratio test, which confirms a proteinuria of more than 3.5 grams per day in association with hypoalbuminemia.
Okay, I think that takes us on really nicely into the next segment I wanted to cover. So we've just gone over a presentation. You then just touched on a type of investigation that you can use. But could you run through the routine diagnostic tests that you'd rely on, and what kind of results you would see in someone that would make you think nephrotic syndrome?
Okay. So first of all, let's start off with some bedside tests. On the bedside, one must identify that a patient actually has edema by performing a physical examination. And signs to look out for would be pitting edema, which presents as a dent when you press with your thumb onto the swollen area where you suspect the bony region is. And then one of the very easy bedside tests would be a urinalysis. So a simple urine dip would be able to tell you whether the patient actually has large amounts of proteinuria. And then this urine can then be sent off to the lab. And the test to request would be a urine protein creatinine ratio and a urine albumin creatinine ratio. Either one would be fine. And alongside that, important blood tests such as the renal function, including the urea, electrolytes, serum creatinine, and EGFR would be helpful to tell us the extent of the kidney damage or whether there is any kidney damage or not. As we know, in the triad is hypoalbuminemia. So serum albumin is an important test, along with serum total protein, liver function tests to rule out chronic liver disease, bone profile to look at the renal function, the long run, if the patient has signs of chronic kidney disease from the blood test, lipid profile, and coagulation screen. And sometimes it is useful to have a look at urine microscopy, but not all of the labs actually does that. And it is good practice to do imaging of the kidneys to ensure the size of the kidneys and also to rule out any obstruction in the kidneys as well. And the importance of looking at the size of the kidneys is because usually in order to diagnose the underlying cause of nephrotic syndrome is a renal biopsy. And the kidneys has to be of certain size to be suitable for biopsy.
Actually, I wanted to ask the difference between a protein creatinine ratio and an albumin creatinine ratio. It indicates the same thing, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah. So it would tell you that there's loads of protein in the urine compared to creatinine, and that would indicate that you've got a compromised podocyte membrane because it's just leaking loads of protein out. Is that correct?
Yes, correct. But sometimes you will get a false high reading as well if a person actually has a lot of hemoglobin that comes from the bladder itself, from underlying bladder tumor or bladder pathology, then that can actually muddle the picture a little bit. So sometimes the nephrologist will do a albumin creatinine ratio and a protein creatinine ratio just to make sure that we are absolutely not muddling the picture. If there is albumin and protein at the same time with nephrotic syndrome, then we can be sure that, okay, this protein is definitely coming from the kidneys.
We're coming to the end of the podcast, but then we need to talk about the most important thing now, actually, which is about the management of someone with nephrotic syndrome. As we've said before, nephrotic syndrome is a syndrome, and therefore we need to recognize the cause of the syndrome in order to identify and treat that rather than treating just the syndrome itself. However, the pillars that you need to address in someone with nephrotic syndrome include, managing and reducing the edema, reducing the proteinuria, and then treating the complications associated with the condition, as well as obviously treating the cause. Esther, do you want to just go through each of those components and tell us what the process is and how we manage these people?
Yes, absolutely. As you know, looking for the underlying cause does take some time, and the patient usually suffers from the complications and the symptoms of edema, and that can be very debilitating for the patients. So the mainstay of these symptom treatments are supportive care, really. And first of all, we want to reduce edema. So the way to reduce edema, there are two ways of doing that. The first way would be to restrict salt and fluid. And this can be done by daily salt and fluid restriction with careful fluid balance monitoring, working very closely with the renal team. And loop diuretics can also be used as a diuretic of choice if the patient cannot meet the salt and fluid restriction efficiently. But of course, when this is in use, the volume status of the patient need to be monitored very carefully to avoid overdiuresis of the patient. So this will include a daily weighing of the patient along with managing the fluid balance. And we'll restrict the salt to less than 2 grams a day with the help of the dietitians. The other way that can be done simultaneously in terms of reducing edema is to add on ACE inhibitors or ARBs. ARB stands for angiotensin receptor blockers. The principle of this is to reduce the glomerular filtration pressure so that there will be less protein being pushed out by the pressure within the glomerulus. It acts on these drugs, creates an effect on the efferent arterial, causing vasodilation And this mechanism will reduce the pressure within the glomerulus, hence reducing the extent of proteinuria. However, this is not treating the underlying cause. So the mainstay of it is still to try and treat the underlying cause, but this is to try and improve the quality of life of the patient while we find out what that underlying cause is and waiting for treatment to kick in. There is one very important complication of nephrotic syndrome, which is the state of hypercoagulability. This is because while losing large amount of protein, antithrombin 3 is also one of the protein that are being lost. In this situation, the patient becomes hypercoagulable, and with that, marrying with the result of reduced mobility and increased bed rest due to massive edema, it becomes a perfect combination to develop venous thromboembolism. Therefore, when approaching a patient with nephrotic syndrome, it is important to commence them on VTE prophylaxis. VTE stands for venous thromboembolism prophylaxis, to prevent this from happening and also to ensure that they keep up with the mobility, if possible, within the hospital. So I want to sum up with these. Obviously, I've covered a lot in terms of the treatment principles. So basically, with the edema, we will tackle it with salt and fluid restriction, with careful fluid balance monitoring, and we'll reduce the proteinuria with ACE inhibitors and ARB. And with that, we control the blood pressure, and we also need to prevent hypercoagulability as with VTE prophylaxis.
So with the VTE prophylaxis that you give them, do you give them low molecular weight heparin, or do you go for unfractionated because they've got a renal impairment?
There are renal doses of low molecular weight heparin that is safe to give if they do have renal impairment with nephrotic syndrome.
So Esther, you've actually touched already on one of the main complications of nephrotic syndrome, which is being hypercoagulable, you know, thromboembolism. However, there's a couple of others, infection and being in a state of hyperlipidemia. How do we address those two other complications?
So infection can occur in the long term in patients who are suffering from nephrotic syndrome and while being on treatment for it, not only because they lose immunoglobulins from the nephrotic syndrome itself as one of the protein, they were also potentially being started on immunosuppressants as well as part of the treatment regime. We normally, on outpatient follow-up, we would advise the patient to ensure that they're up to date with their immunization. We would recommend them to have yearly influenza vaccines and 5-yearly pneumococcal vaccines. At the same time, if they're on immunosuppressants, then we would also want them to be careful if they were traveling, especially to exotic areas where they have to have extra vaccinations because they are not eligible to have any live vaccines while being on immunosuppressants. In terms of hyperlipidemia, this is a special kind of complication that mostly occurs in minimal change disease and also in membranous nephropathy, mainly because of the heavy amount of proteinuria that they have in these disease. In this situation, once the underlying cause is treated, then the hyperlipidemia itself will actually resolve on its own once the disease is treated. However, if there is a recurrence of the disease or if the disease is not responding to treatment or taking longer than expected, then we would usually start the patient on statin for long-term prevention of cardiovascular diseases.
Awesome. So, Esther, as a renal registrar, what would you want people to take home from this podcast? Just a couple of key messages of things that they should hold on to in their brains, be it for clinical practice or to sit an exam. What are your key messages?
Okay, so the key messages here would be to recognize nephrotic syndrome and to be familiar with the triad of nephrotic syndrome, which is proteinuria of more than 3.5 grams per day associated with hypoalbuminemia and generalized edema. And it is important as junior doctors to recognize the treatment principles of nephrotic syndrome, which includes reduction of edema, reduction of proteinuria, and to look out for the complications that comes with nephrotic syndrome, which are thromboembolism, so starting VTE prophylaxis promptly, and salt and fluid restriction with careful fluid balance monitoring.
So I think that's it for today's podcast. We hope you all enjoyed it. To test your application of today's knowledge, please head over to our website at pababble.com for high yield revision notes and a question bank. We'll see you next time. This podcast was brought to you by Pababble, with special thanks to Esther for joining us today.